Welcome to the good old days. I'm Jerome Manigan. I have stories for you from the September 2006 issue of the Good Old Days magazine. We're starting today's program with this by Harvey A. Miller, Threshing Day, 1939. It was 5 a.m. and the aromas of bacon, eggs, toast, fried potatoes, and onions and coffee permeated the air. I slid out of my pajamas and into one-piece summer BVDs. Then I put on a long-sleeve shirt and my blue Oshkosh bib overalls with watch pocket and hammer strap. A red bandana crammed into the hip pocket completed my outfit for this special day. The threshers were coming. I bounded down the stairs to the kitchen, where I worked the handle of the small pitcher pump next to the sink. I filled the white porcelain enamel basin that was kept in the sink and washed my hands and face. Then I poured the dirty water into the sink, which drained outside the house, and wiped my hands and face on the flour sack towel that hung on the door casing. Grandpa and Frank, the hired man, had already fed the livestock and milked the 9 cows. At breakfast, I sat next to Grandpa at the big square green table covered with a faded blue-checked oilcloth. I helped myself to 2 fried eggs and a thick slice of bacon from the platter, and then added a spoonful of fried potatoes and a slice of toast with lots of soft butter. Grandma mixed me cocoa instead of the coffee the grown-ups drank. My stomach felt stretched after I had cleaned my plate. Grandpa liked a heaping bowl of Kellogg's cornflakes before he had the hot breakfast. He and the hired man washed down their food with 2 or 3 cups of coffee loaded with plenty of sugar and cream. By 5:45 a.m., we 3 men were ready to go to work. We could see dust rising as the neighbors' wagons came down the road, and we could hear the puffing of the big steam tractor with iron wheels that towed the threshing machine. An ear-splitting whoa, whoa burst from the tractor whistle as the rig moved into the front yard. The tractor operator supervised as men moved the threshing machine to its final position close to the barn by the barnyard fence. They blocked the wheel so that the machine could not roll. The steam tractor occasionally generated sparks, so it remained far away from the threshing machine and the barn. A long, wide, flat belt extended halfway across the yard, running from the tractor to the power wheel on the threshing machine. Once everything was running, the horse-drawn wagons, piled high with wheat, moved into place alongside the intake conveyor, and the sheaves were dropped into it. The noise, dust, and activity did not seem to bother the built Belgium mares and geldings as they stood still for unloading. Once his wagon was unloaded, the driver would pull away from the rig, and the next one pulled up. The conveyor was never empty because everything was so well coordinated. Many wagons were bringing in the crop, and at least one was always waiting to unload. No slackers were allowed. Meanwhile, back in the fields, more golden shocks of wheat waited. Grandpa had built them a week earlier from the bound sheaves produced by the McCormick reaper or binder. The shocks were spaced so that a wagon at one shock would not interfere with a wagon at the next one. As sheaves were pitched up onto our wagon. Grandpa and I positioned them so as to get the maximum load. Once in a while, we heard a yell when someone was surprised by a snake under a shock. Everyone laughed and teased the one who had yelled. After all, snakes ate the mice that ate the grain. Once the wheat was stacked as high as the end racks, Grandpa and I headed for the threshing machine. By 11 a.m., breakfast was in the distant past, and the dinner bell was a most welcome sound. Threshing was hard work, and the men were hungry and thirsty. A crude table, the one usually used to wash garden vegetables, had been set up outside next to the back porch. Here the men found wash basins, pails of water, brown fells naphtha soap, and flour sack towels hung from nails. The last man had hardly finished getting the grime off of his face, arms, and hands when Grandma appeared on the porch wearing her gingham apron. "Come on in," she announced. What a meal! Grandma and the thresher's wives had worked it out so that all could work in the kitchen at one time to prepare the food. After a short grace, the men helped themselves from the large bowls and platters of food as they were passed around. As soon as a serving dish was empty, it was taken to the kitchen to be refilled. Platters were piled high with fried chicken, pork chops, and boiled beef. There were lots of mashed potatoes, green beans, lima beans, carrots, beets, and turnips. Cabbage had been shaved to make creamy, sweet coleslaw. The meal included corn relish, pickled beets, pickled pears, sweet pickles, dill pickles, and celery sticks. Man-sized hot biscuits were spread with butter and a choice of strawberry, pineapple, or raspberry jam. Everything was eaten with great gusto, washed down with iced tea, hot coffee, or cold water. After two or three full plates, the men were ready for dessert. Out came the pies, elderberry, huckleberry, peach, cherry, and apple. All were served in wide soup bowls so that cream could be added. Chocolate cake with chocolate frosting and yellow cake with lots of brown sugar frosting were offered, as well as big sugar cookies with a dark raisin in the middle. There was some farm talk and a little storytelling, but a harvest dinner was serious business. There was no lingering over coffee or dessert. Everyone knew that they had to go back to work. A shrill whoop, whoop, whoop from the steam tractor signaled that it was time to start again. The women had been too busy to eat before now, but every plate and piece of silverware was dirty and had to be washed before anyone else could eat. Plenty of food was left for the women and the children who were too young to work in the fields. In previous years, I had stayed with the children who played near the house or helped with the mill, but this year was different. Because I had worked with Grandpa and helped stack the sheaves, I had earned the right to eat with the men at the big table. Naturally, I didn't say much besides please and thank you, and answer when one of the ladies asked, "Alfred, would you like another serving of something?" At age 11, I wanted to appear grown up, so I made sure that I laughed when the men around me did. Mostly, though, I didn't understand what was so funny. After dinner, Grandpa decided that I could watch the threshing operation, which he figured would be finished by 4 o'clock. Finishing before dusk left time for the threshing rig to be readied for the trip to the next farm. The tractor operator showed me the orange color of the flames that told him when to throw in a shovel of coal. I watched the sheaves on the conveyor being chopped open by long knives as the wheat disappeared just inside the opening. The threshed grain poured out a chute at the end of the machine. Two men controlled the flow by a lift gate, while another man held a brown burlap gunny sack in place at the mouth of the chute. The bag filled quickly with about a bushel of grain. Once the bag was full, it was carried to the barn and dumped. Two men, or sometimes three, were required to keep up with the machine and carry the wheat to the bin. I was fascinated by the straw and chaff that blew out of a big pipe that extended over the barnyard fence. The pipe moved from side to side and back and forth, controlling the straw placement. The whole thing was guided by a stacker who sat on a bench up high on top of the machine. I stood close to the barn for a while, my hands in my pockets, just watching how he made that straw go exactly where it needed to be to make a perfect straw stack. Suddenly, he motioned for me to come up onto the machine with him. He pointed to the iron bar, steps just below his seat. Undaunted, I climbed up, holding firmly onto the iron steps. When I was seated on the bench, the man showed me how to tie my bandana across my nose and mouth to keep out the dust and chaff. Then he showed me how the straw blower's side-to-side movements were controlled by a flat lever marked with an L and an R in front of the bench. He used his foot to move the lever ever so slightly to shift the nozzle where he wanted the straw to go. He pulled a rope that was attached to the jointed deflector to make the straw go farther out and loosened it to bring the straw in closer. He let me try it, and I was soon building a straw stack just like a real thresher. I felt downright important up there, laying that straw in just right. After evening chores were finished and everyone had gone back to their farms, Grandpa, Grandma, and I had a last piece of elderberry pie. Grandma said, "Alfred, I heard you were on top of the threshing machine handling the straw blower." Grandpa chimed in, "And he did a darn good job of making that straw stack in the barnyard." I grinned. It had been a good day. Threshing Day, 1939, was written by Harvey A. Miller. Turning elsewhere, in the September 2006 issue of the Good Old Days magazine, let's hear Garden Memories. It's written by Letty Sidens. In 70 years, home has moved some 30 times, but although I never actually lived there, the place for which I've been homesick most often is great-grandmother Hannah Rogers' country home. Being born on a rented farm in Sullivan County, Missouri, just a few miles from grandmother, allowed her to plant the seed for my love of the country. I made frequent visits to her homestead until I was 14, sometimes staying for a week or two during summer vacation. In later years, I had to travel 90 miles to enjoy such delightful days. When I was a small child, it was thrilling to visit her home in November or even December and see the yellow and white chrysanthemums blooming in the bay window of the sitting room. These plants had been replanted from her garden into large containers. It was a mystery to me how she could have these blooming inside when snow covered those still in the garden. Oleanders were also removed from the summer garden to share their pink blossom beauty throughout the winter months. Oleander grew 4 feet tall or more, and she had to enlist the help of men in the family to move them inside. She endured some good-natured grumbling from my dad when he was the moving man. In the yard south of the house were two long gardens, approximately 6 feet wide, just about the right width so that she could care for them easily from grassy walkways on either side. The garden nearest the house contained a wide variety of flowers, while the other provided space for herbs and vegetables, more like a kitchen garden. Far beyond the yard fence was the regular garden for corn, potatoes, tomatoes, and other crops needing more space. In the middle of the flower garden was a small wooden frame that boxed columbine. I thought this must have been her pride and joy, and I still think that columbine are special. Now I suspect that the wooden frame had once held a climbing rose. The garden had the usual array of cosmos, geraniums, larkspur, bleeding hearts, and some plants whose names I don't now know. Even in her 90s, she continued an interest in her garden. My favorite flowers were planted in a special plot on either side of the doorway to the screened porch at the side of the house. On the porch itself was a leather fainting couch along with a couple of straight chairs, a small table, and a rocking chair. The porch was used for brief naps, shelling peas, snapping beans, churning, and other similar country chores. One afternoon, I selected a book from her extensive library. Great-grandmother's daybed was in the dining room, and it beckoned me to recline and read. Unfortunately, I neglected to remove my shoes. They were rather new and clean before climbing in for a splendid treat in a make-believe world. A stern rebuke from grandmother brought me back to reality and sent me scurrying to the porch where my tears of humiliation flowed. But I found solace there, bathed in the lovely fragrance of the delicate white, pink, and lavender phlox. In later years, every time our family moved, I'd plant as many flowers as I could afford and care for properly. Sometimes it was only one variety, something I remembered from Hannah's garden. Writing about this stirs memory fresh within me, since we are planning to move again next month. In my mind, on scraps of paper and in nursery catalogs are plans for revamping and extending a garden there yet this fall, a tiny legacy of Hannah's garden. Garden Memories was written by Letty Siddons. And let's listen to Mama's Mama. This is by Robert E. Thompson. More than 60 years have slipped by since that day in 1938 when my grandmother passed away. I was 1 week shy of my 10th birthday. I was sitting on the cold linoleum floor of the dining room lacing up my high cuts when my father emerged from the bedroom to announce that my mother had a headache and would be out in a few minutes. The very fact that mother was not the first one up should have raised a red flag, but it didn't. When she did appear a few minutes later, it was to tell us that Grandma had passed away during the night. Grandma had entered the hospital a few days ago to undergo a routine appendectomy. All seemed to go well until an infection-caused fever raged out of control. And by shortly after midnight, she was gone. But it was not Grandma's death that I want to write about. It's her life. Grandma shared our home. Indeed, it was contributions from her small pension that kept the mortgage paid during the Depression years when my father was out of work. She had a two-room apartment with a separate entrance on the second floor of the house. It was heated by a small pot-bellied wood-burning stove with mica windows in the door. It was my job to make sure that adequate wood was carried up from the basement bin each morning and that the ashes were removed and disposed of properly. That disposal included hauling 2 bushel baskets of ashes to the local landfill. We called it the dump in my old Houston Flyer wagon each Saturday. On a very good day, neighbors would ask me to haul their ashes to the dump too, which put a nickel of my very own into my knicker's pocket. Summers were difficult for Grandma in those days before air conditioning. On very warm days, she often sat in a rocker or on the front porch swing, stirring the air around her wrinkled face with a wooden-handled funeral parlor fan. For active youngsters ranging in age from 6 to 18, sometimes became too much for her. Then she would retreat to her own apartment, seeking peace and quiet. Among my happiest memories of Grandma are those of returning from school to find her in the kitchen, baking bread with flour supplied by the city relief department, or of finding the kitchen table loaded with drying homemade noodles, which soon would be part of the hearty chicken soup that was one of Grandma's specialties. In earlier days, Grandmother had supported herself and her 5 children by cooking at the church campground during the annual camp meetings. She had a knack for making the best pie crusts in the world, a talent she passed on to my mother either by heredity or by example. During the 10 short years I knew her, Mama's mama was a beautiful example of faith, hope, and love, born of a close communion with her Savior and of a genuine concern for people. Fortunately, those qualities, like the ability to make pie crusts, were passed on to my mother, so they were not lacking in my life after Grandma's death. Perhaps my fondest memory of Grandma is of seeing her alone with her Bible, reading and praying, sometimes aloud for her children and her grandchildren, including me. Like Timothy, whom the Apostle Paul reminded of the sincere faith which first lived in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, I owe a great deal to my grandmother Blanche and my mother Grace. Mama's Mama was written by Robert E. Thompson. And in the final minutes of today's program, let's listen to this by Dorothy Coleman, Chautauqua. Mrs. Bertie Brown, the teacher in the big room of our 2-room school, finished reading the daily chapter of Billy Whiskers to settle us down after the lunch hour. Then she closed the book and said, "You've probably heard that Chautauqua is coming to Fawn Grove for 3 days and nights. We have permission to close the school at 2 o'clock on those afternoons so you can attend the performances. If your parents choose not to buy a ticket for the afternoon performance, you are free to go home." We were invited to give recitations or a monologue and sing one song on the last afternoon, she continued. "Tell your parents about it. If they want to attend, bring the money tomorrow for your tickets, 50 cents for all 3 afternoons. A buzz circled the room. I remembered that a good time was had last year. Mother had punched a hole in my ticket and hung it around my neck on a cord so that I wouldn't lose it. I was in 4th grade. We walked hand in hand to the Grange Hall at the fairgrounds where the performances were presented. What a treat to see real live entertainment in 1923 in our small community of Fawn Grove, Pennsylvania." Our teacher explained that the talented performers worked together in the town of Chautauqua on the shore of Lake Chautauqua in New York State. There they put together a variety of programs to bring education and entertainment to rural communities on the Chautauqua circuit. They came by train, usually in groups of 8 or 10. In Fawn Grove, which was at the end of the rail line, they found room and board at Duncan's boarding house, just a short walk from the Grange Hall. Sometimes some lodged with local residents. A stage was set up at one end of the Grange Hall, and heavy curtains were hung across the back and sides on wires. Small rooms behind the stage served as dressing rooms. Steps concealed by curtains led up to the stage, making the Grange Hall seem like a real theater. The stage was strong enough to support the piano needed for some performances. I remember the piano especially because I played it when our class sang Peggy O'Neill. We had only the old pump organ at school, so it was a treat to have the piano. During the 3 days and nights of their stay, the performers put on short plays and danced, described as interpretive. Artists sketched on large sheets of paper on easels using charcoal and colored chalks. Lecturers spoke while showing lantern slides of faraway places. They called them travelogues. There was lots of singing, folk dancing in costume, monologues, we called it elocution, and nature talks and bird calls. One afternoon after the show, one young lady from the group took a group of children for a walk to a nearby pond. She pointed out all sorts of things we missed when we played there. An American Indian in full regalia, feathered headdress, beaded vest, leather moccasins, and face painted with mysterious designs impressed me mightily. He created a painting of a desert sunset in glorious colors using colored sand. Seeing a real live Indian in Fawn Grove was unusual, but I loved the dancing and singing best. Proud parents clapped heartily for our contribution to the festivities. My imagination was captivated. I danced on that stage. I hit those high notes. I entertained with my monologues. I dazzled audiences with my virtuosity at the keyboard. I can dream, can't I? Chautauqua did bring culture to the farming community. We talked about it for days afterward. Talented young people still go to Lake Chautauqua every summer to hone their artistic skills. Oldsters rent tiny cottages in the compound and spend their afternoons and evenings absorbing the cultural programs. The event recalls a kinder and gentler era when Chautauqua debuted in 1874 at the Chautauqua Lake Sunday School Assembly. The Chautauqua Symphony Orchestra, founded in 1929, and the Chautauqua Opera Company still give performances every summer. A Chautauqua Ballet Company and the Chautauqua Conservatory Theater also perform at the Chautauqua Institution on Chautauqua Lake during the 9-week session. Chautauqua is alive and well, and it is still enjoyed in many communities today. Chautauqua was written by Dorothy Coleman. And with that, we're at the end of today's edition of The Good Old Days. This is Jerome Manigan, inviting you to join me again next week, same place, same time, for another journey back in time to the good old days. Bye-bye. The Good Old Days was recorded in the studios of Radio Reading Services, WRRS, the voice of information by Robin Clemens.